2002. And of course, since that time, he has not only given a presentation at Ars on the history of Homer Roadheaver's Rainbow Records, but it has also been published as an article in the Ars Journal. And he has contributed liner notes to albums ranging from the music of Leroy Anderson to Valentin Silvestrov, and contributes on a regular basis to the All Music Guide, which we use on a regular basis at our library, while remaining active, still active,
as
a musician and a composer. And I present Uncle Dave.
Thank you. First track, please.
This is Columbia's Jazz Laboratory. For long hair, short hair, yes, and even bald pates, this is the show for educated gates. Music that's sweet and music that's hot by that master musician, Raymond Scott.
I'm Uncle Dave Lewis. Next slide. I do that. That's my job. I would like to thank the following organizations and individuals: Erwin Chusid and Jeff Winner at the Raymond Scott Archive, Chuck Haddix, and the lovely staff of the Mars Sound Archive of the University of Missouri at Kansas City, part of the Miller-Nichols Library. Some of those folks are here. Pete Traders and Gert-Jan Blond of Basta Records in the Netherlands, Raymond Scott's widow, Missy Scott, Allison Lewis, Matt Smith, and artist Byron Werner, who rediscovered Scott ahead of all the rest of us. The last 20 years has witnessed a renaissance of interest in Raymond Scott, and if you are a young music fan, he's always been there for you. However, there was a time where that was definitely not the case, and that was only about 20 years ago. Folks who like animation, they certainly know of his music, even if they don't know of his name, because his music was used in the Warner Brothers cartoons very extensively. To fans of techno and to musicians who practice techno, Raymond Scott is regarded as a kind of godfather of the medium. However, it's only been a couple of decades since any of this recognition has come along. When Raymond Scott died in 1994, his comeback was barely underway. He died a couple weeks after the Northridge earthquake, and his home was located in Van Nuys, which was not far from the epicenter. When a debilitating stroke ended Raymond Scott's activity in 1987, this is the situation with his collection. It was crammed into his garage, piled up in his studio, squirreled away in a chicken coop, part of it in a tin shed, and hidden throughout the house. The Mars Sound Archive offered to take control of the collection even before Scott passed away, but various circumstances kept it in the earthquake zone for about another year after he died. Finally, one day, conservators showed up at the house in Van Nuys and packed the entire collection into a 24-foot truck and took it back to Kansas City. On the right is Byron Werner, who discovered Scott's music even before Erwin Chusid did, turned Erwin on to Scott. "Say, I know that guy. An earthquake struck while we were sorting the records, and I threw myself over top of a 4-foot stack of 16-inch glass transcription records. And faced with that choice again, I'm not sure that I would do it again, and it's a hell of a way to impress one's colleagues, but nevertheless, the collection made it safely back to Kansas City." The collection has been cataloged by the Miller-Nichols Library staff, expertly, I might add, and the PDF file for Raymond Scott's collection runs to 553 pages. Okay, that's my phone. I need to get rid of it. Now, Raymond Scott told Wally Heider in 1983 that he believed that he had lost the best things in his collection already. And there was some shrinkage of the collection over the years for various reasons. Recently, several of those things have come back. Another cache of records was discovered in the house of Raymond Scott's first wife, Pearl, last year, and also a large collection that Scott had loaned out to a friend that turned up in at eBay, mysteriously later turned up at the Rodgers and Hammerstein archive as a donation. I thank Seth Winner for that information. Let's see. As Erwin Chusid first observed, Scott was a pack rat of his own recordings. He had plenty of opportunities to record his music. He was active as a musical director for CBS Radio from 1934 to 1949, as a band leader on television through 1957, on at least four live tours in the 1940s, and as a commercial recording artist himself from 1937 to 1970. And he had ample opportunities to record his music, and he did so in every format that it came to him. And that would include uncoated aluminums, lacquers, glass base, tests, commercial records, and even the stampers to commercial records, open reel tapes, cassette tapes, and at least one 5-inch floppy disk. Scott's career cut a Zelig-like path through American music from 1932 to 1987, and despite the losses, the collection traces that entire timeline, covering one facet or another of all of his activity. Raymond Scott was born under the name Harry Warnow in Brooklyn in 1908 to a family of musically inclined Russian-Jewish immigrants. His older brother, Mark Warnow, was named a director of life music for CBS Radio in 1929, which was the year the network went on the air. Young Scott was an electronic tinkerer and earned a diploma in electrical engineering from a correspondence course at the age of 16. Scott's improvisations at the piano so impressed his older brother that Mark Warnow bribed him with the gift of a grand piano in order to enter the Institute of Musical Art, which is now called Juilliard. He graduated in 1934, and he went straight to CBS. And to avoid accusations of nepotism, he picked a name at random out of the Manhattan telephone directory and renamed himself Raymond Scott. In 1932, Scott obtained an aluminum disc cutter. The earliest recordings in the Scott collections are of telephone conversations. Next track, please.
Well, I thought I'd be able to help you technically.
Why? I mean, how?
Well, how do you imagine?
I don't know.
Come on. Can't you recite the, the Paradise Lost or something?
Where are you anyway?
Well, I was wondering, I mean, if you could listen to yourself recite, whether it would be any aid to you.
What?
I mean, I was wondering whether if you could listen to yourself recite a few lines, I was wondering whether that would be a help to you.
Once Scott wearied of trying to get people to talk on the phone while he was recording them, he began recording air checks of his brother's broadcasts, preserving for us some early OTR programming that certainly would not otherwise have come down to us, such as the 1933 program, Curtain Calls. Next track, please.
Curtain Calls. Tonight, and each successive Wednesday evening, under the baton of Mark Warnow, we shall recall to you one of the happy events of the light opera stage of the past. And tonight, we begin the series with a reverie of Blossom Time, Sigmund Romberg's delightful fantasy on the life and love and music of the immortal Franz Schubert.
Scott's own earliest recordings come from September 1934 and consist of piano solos recorded during a 15-minute slot he held on the CBS schedule. his first radio show, playing pieces such as his own Happy in Harlem. Next
swing
track,
the spotlight please. Over to the piano, where the nimble fingers of Raymond Scott are weaving off the syncopated harmonies of what might be called ivory idiosyncrasies, but we were afraid that the announcer might not be able to pronounce that, so we call it the modernistic sketch, Happy in Harlem.
Also in September 1934, he led a group of about 10 musicians on a program called The Instrumentalists that ran only through January of 1935. This group included the young Bunny Berrigan and Dave Harris, later the saxophonist of the Raymond Scott Quintet, and drummer Johnny Williams, father to John of Star Wars fame. Other participants are unclear and remain controversial. Nevertheless, a small surviving group of recordings from the Instrumentalists have an almost avant-garde quality, and Irwin doesn't agree with me on this, but I think anticipate aspects of free jazz. And their recordings are characterized by some of Berrigan's wildest flights of fancy.
Loretta Lee, the queen in the realm of syncopation, and now here comes the king.
Berrigan. This is an African earbender. Haunted House on New Year's Eve, January 1, 1935. Some years ago, I had the audacity, really naivete, of suggesting that the violin solo that you just heard might be the work of Joe Venuti. Well, I got an agitated response from the late Bosie White that said, "No, no, 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 not in a million years, Joe Venuti." Now, it's true, it isn't Joe, because Joe was in October 1934. He was in Europe. However, that begs the question, well, then, who the hell is it? It's a great solo, and this is a consistent problem in the Scott collection in terms of identifying from date to date who the personnel was working on all of these various broadcasts. And it's a question that, you know, might take 20 or 30 years to answer. We do know, however, who comprised Raymond Scott's most famous group, the Raymond Scott Quintet, in its main run from 1936 to 1940. The original Scott Quintet debuted on the CBS radio program Europe Hit Parade on Christmas Eve 1936 with Scott's piece, The Toy Trumpet, under the name of the Toy Town Quintet. The original lineup consisted of Dave Harris, Johnny Williams, Pete Pumiglio, who was had played earlier with Ed Kirkby's band, Dave Wade on muted trumpet, and Lou Shuby, who was later an important producer at Columbia, on bass. Scott didn't count his own piano in the group, so even though they were a quintet, they were a six-piece group. Sometime in January 1937, the quintet debuted what would become Scott's most famous composition, Powerhouse. This and three other pieces were recorded at Scott's first commercial recording session on February 20, 1937, at the newly installed Master Records firm headed by publisher Irving Mills. The next voice you will hear very briefly will be that of Bunny Berrigan.
And now, Swing It, Paul Douglas.
Now, you know, it was the Saturday before Christmas and all through the house. Yes, it was, the Saturday night before Christmas, and all, well, a small combination out of the swing club band calling themselves the Toy Town Quintet gave us Raymond Scott's Christmas Fantasy, the Toy Trumpet. Later, they came back with a new composition. Yes, you know the one I mean, Twilight in Turkey. Now, wait a minute. Whoa, wait a minute. Acclaim as something new in jazz, and naturally we're very proud of them.
Scott did more, whoops, wrong way. Sorry, there we go. Scott did more at Master than just record his own group. He engineered many of its recordings for other artists, and these do tend to be cleaner and quieter than other late 1930s American records. He also probably came in contact with John Kirby at that time, who also recorded for Master and who played with Scott's group in the 40s. They were working towards similar artistic ends. I don't know if you're familiar with Kirby's work, but it's kind of like Scott's. And other composers who were kind of working in this semi-intellectual swing vein would have been Alec Wilder, Bert Schefter, and Alan Shulman, all of whom had contact with the conservatory like Scott, shared an enthusiasm for Ellington and figures like Reginald Forsythe. As the fame and success of the quintet began to pick up, Scott established his own recording studio in New York, picking up radio broadcasts through the New York City pipe system and also making private recordings. Scott's records bore this remarkable M.C. Escher-esque label, which he may have had a hand in designing. It's not clear when the studio itself closed down, but he continued to use this label through about 1944. Sometimes his record labels contain information about which pipe was accessed, the time of day, and other details about the recording. In 1938, Scott began to work with what he called his expanded quintet, which added three or four members to the existing six, and this evolved very quickly into his new orchestra, as it's called on this Columbia record label. This was a smaller than usual big band, and Scott's arrangements have a very distinctive sound, often emphasizing a crisp approach to rhythmic attack and choruses in high registers, such as in their first studio recording, Get Happy. Pete Buimiglio. Scott subsequently toured with this group, but his tours were not successful, and the sale of his standing catalog to the Warner Brothers Music Division, which made his material in turn accessible to Carl Stalling for use in Bugs Bunny cartoons, was a measure taken by Scott to recover from losses on the road. Scott mounted another big band in 1942, and this was the best of his live non-radio orchestras, which recorded for Decca. However, this group also folded owing to wartime conscription and the recording ban. Thankfully, Scott had the sense not to quit his day job at CBS. And after that second band folded, he just worked at CBS full time. He had several different radio programs. For example, Pan American Hotspot, which was dedicated to Latin music, and that boasted one of Scott's most distinctive radio themes. Among other shows Scott worked on were Concert in Rhythm, Opera in Rhythm, and Jazz Laboratory, a hip hoedown of Hot and Sweet that ran for quite some time and featured celebrity guest announcers, such as Jose Ferrar, heard here in a Jazz Laboratory broadcast dating from August 1942.
In fourth position, number one, carrying 115 pounds, Raymond Scott. He gets off with his own interpretation of a number that is guaranteed to raise the roof and bend the beams. Maestro, make with I Got Rhythm.
Charlie Shavers. A personal aside, just my opinion, those who say that Raymond Scott's work has no relevance to jazz don't know what they're talking about. The largest part of the discs in Scott's collection is concentrated in radio band recordings and rehearsals dating from 1942 to 44. And we're lucky for that because in 43, Scott organized for a radio which has a band that has been called in retrospective the Million Dollar Band, a mixed orchestra of black and white players. Among its members were John Kirby, Charlie Shavers, Harry Sweets Edison, saxophonist Ben Webster, pianist Johnny Guarnieri, and drummer Cozy Cole. And there was no opposition to this idea from CBS because they were thinking it was making the best of the available pool of musicians in New York at the time. However, there was opposition from the Black Musicians Union because they were afraid that integration would lead to the dissolution of their union. And actually, it did about 20 years later. And so from a broken 16-inch glass disc in the collection, here is the Million Dollar Band jamming on Scott's New York Concerto. Ben Webster.
It's got an agitated sound again. That's what we keep it from getting agitated by staying simple. Too many fill-ins once in a while makes the thing get a little bit fast.
By most accounts, as a band leader, Raymond Scott was a thankless taskmaster, doling out little praise and plenty of hardship. This example we just heard, "It's Getting Too Agitated," is comparatively mild compared to the furious outburst preserved in other rehearsals. Nevertheless, plenty of good musicians wanted to work in Scott's band on radio because it was a comfortable, steady gig and good pay. Ben Webster liked playing the sweet, straightforward, and sentimental dance music that the Scott Band was often required to perform as a matter of course, for example. Another area in which Scott was involved at CBS was in creating production music for dramatic series. Those of you who are interested in old-time radio and have heard a lot of these programs might recognize a couple of these bumpers. You know, Fibber McGee and Molly walking along. Tense action scene. We'll skip the next audio track forward. At the end of 1944, Scott withdrew from all of his professional engagements in order to spend 1945 concentrating on the show Lute Song, written with Bernard Hannigan, and opening on Broadway February the 6th, 1946, with Mary Martin as the star. Scott discovered a Canadian singer whom he renamed Dorothy Collins, and between 1946 and 48, he mounted a couple of tours with a small big band primarily featuring her, and though the big bands themselves were on life support, these tours with Dorothy did reasonably well. Scott began recording in 1946 for the MGM label, and he was one of their first artists, recording a surprising number of sides with the company, none of which have ever been reissued. With Dorothy in tow, he gradually returned to radio on shows like the 1949 The Good Listening program with Durwood Kirby. In 1949 also, Scott's brother, Mark Warno, longtime leader of the Your Hit Parade program, died suddenly, and the job was offered to Scott. He accepted it, and Dorothy Collins also joined the cast. When the show moved to television in 1950, Scott and Dorothy moved along with it. Your Hit Parade was sort of like the American Idol of its day, except that the singing cast members weren't in competition with one another and merely sang the hits in a given week. It was sponsored, as had been the case on radio, by Lucky Strike Cigarettes, and the show itself was practically a smoking orgy, with Scott unfortunately being the only non-smoker on the set. However, he may have objected to working in a constant cloud. A large part of Scott's collection is devoted to audio recordings of the rehearsals for Your Hit Parade program, and they're damn funny. During Your Hit Parade, he traded in on his celebrity through making several albums for Decca's choral division and releasing some recordings on his own Autovox label, with pieces such as Dedicatory Piece to the Crew and Passengers of the First Rocket Express to the Moon. By this time, he's discovered Bach. Thank you. at the end of the 19th, this is a cover shot from TV Guide, by the way, of Dorothy and Scott and their daughter Deb. At the end of the 1957, NBC fired the entire cast of Your Hit Parade because the incursion of rock and roll into the hit marketplace spelled the death knell for the cast. However, Dorothy was asked back 6 months later and stayed with the show till the end. This really upped the ante in terms of Scott doing something with his electronic music inventions, and he went rather aggressively into commercial advertising. We don't have a lot of information about his electronic music in terms of detail, but this set on Basta pretty much covers what exists of the recordings. And it's one of the smallest parts of the Scott collection because he mainly used tape to test equipment, and ads are necessarily very short. However, we do have a long tape of Scott discussing his electronic inventions. That was a rehearsal for the Advertising Age Convention of 1962, at which Scott spoke and basically introduced to advertisers the potential of electronic music. In this next segment, he describes an invention which is basically the analog equivalent of a modern sound design bench.
When post-scoring television commercials, like, for instance, the one you just saw, a moviola is a must, in my opinion, to integrate as effectively as possible, as accurately as possible, video, announce track, and the background electronic score. We have installed a closed-circuit TV camera on the moviola. The reason for this is that as you work around the music studio, the swivel-type TV monitor enables you to observe pictures from all around the room. So regardless of where you are, when manipulating controls to test certain effects, you can still see picture. I thought you might be interested to see this additional use of closed-circuit TV for conventional music scoring. This was installed some 5 years ago. When one composes at the piano, the presence of the moviola picture directly in front of you makes possible a really sensitive relationship between music and picture. Remote controls enable completely normal moviola operation from the piano position. In addition, by the way, there is provision for recording directly on the moviola, in sync with the picture, a piano version of the intended orchestra score, both for artistic evaluation, sharpen it up, and timing purposes.
Go to the next track.
You know, if one were...
Oh, well, okay. We skipped a track, but this is fine. This is the electronium. All of Scott's components in one machine. It was an artificially intelligent computer. You turned it on and it could play itself. He built it in 1967. And in fact, the next act, go ahead, play the next one. He had a secret keyboard inside the electronium which he could slide out. And so he could play along with it while it played itself. So in 1967, Scott was dealing with the issue of interactivity. Bill's about to give me the bum's rush, so this is the final example. Raymond was never able to sell anything from the electronium. It was a totally impractical instrument. In the 1970s, though, Berry Gordy took an interest in it, and so Raymond moved to California to work at Motown. He retired from Motown in 77, and he had taken so many parts from the electronium to fix things at Motown that it was left as a shell. However, in the early 1980s, he bought a personal computer and took a standard, like, community college computer course, and wrote his last music compositions on a DX7 keyboard that was being driven by a MIDI program from a Radio Shack computer. 1987. And so as you can see, Scott's career makes this incredible trajectory through American music history, through some very, very remote things to things that sound very contemporary. And I know of no other large collection devoted to a music individual who was active in the mass media that has that kind of reach. And if you're interested in the jazz players of the 1940s and 30s, you need to contact the MAR to see if they have something on that subject. And in addition to that, if you are interested in electronic music, old-time radio, these are things that you will find in pretty considerable and significant numbers in the Scott collection. And I know no collection that is quite as rich as his, and I'm very personally proud to have been involved in its preservation. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Dave.